Welcome back again. We finished up the last module with taking a look at how to handle some input. Mm-hmm. Now that we got some input, we're probably going to have some objects bumping into one another. So this will probably be a good time to talk about physics and collision.
That's right, physics and collision detection. There's a lot of different ways to do that. Now, for this game, it shouldn't be too complex. I mean, there's only a cube and another cube and that cylinder we're standing on. So we'll take a look at how we're going to handle all that. So first up, we're going to plan what we need. That's an important approach. This module is basically broken down into how you should approach doing physics in any game, not just this game, okay? Just the mental process that you want to work through, much like we did in the first module where we approached what we need to build our game, what we want to look at and that kind of stuff. So we're going to plan what we need, then we're going to plan our approach for what we need, and then common pitfalls that people run into, as well as simplifying it down and implementing the actual physics after that. So getting underway, planning what we need. What needs physics in your game? That's the first thing. I mean, you can make a lot of games with no physics whatsoever. Okay, a lot of games don't need any kind of physics. A lot of more AAA mainstream games, though, however, include physics whenever possible because we love watching ragdolls fly all over the place when things explode, so we want them in there as much as possible. At that point, you have to decide, is it a mechanic or is it an effect? Does the physics matter to the player or is it just for awe and hilarity? Those are the things that you really need to look at because they will determine really how much, one, how much time you should spend on it, and two, if it's okay to cut that later on if you don't have time to do it, you plan to, you didn't get to it. So you'll want to lay out what needs physics, whether it's an effect or a mechanic, if it's important and so on. For example, if it was canned, would anyone even notice? Okay.
So by canned, you mean something that, you know, if I hit an object, the object would move the same no matter where I hit it from.
Right, or you broke something and it fell apart in a certain way. Yeah. Does it matter if it looks exactly the same every time? Or something like that. If they only crack two crates in your entire game and it's 12 hours long, one's at the first hour in, one's at the last hour in, they're probably not going to notice that the crate broke exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. So it could just be a canned animation that just plays rather than trying to put physics on a thing that you smash that then interacts with each other and falls down. In fact, the animator can probably make it look better than real than that you're going to be able to implement with your physics, right? So you probably want to take that approach. And that there's a lot of cases where that's more important. Some people just, oh, I need physics on everything. No, you don't. It probably looks better if you don't have physics on certain things. And that kind of knowing when to do which one, it comes down to experience and what you're going to have time to implement. So it's something to assess and keep in mind while we're doing this. Are collisions part of the physics system or simply triggers that cause physical reactions? This is really just a mindset more than anything. Do we want collision detection to be part of our physics system or is it just something activated when an event occurs? For example, in a lot of shooter games, when the player finally dies, he plays a ragdoll, falls down on the ground, or then takes the force of the last bullet to wherever it hit and reacts with a ragdoll physics in that way. That's more of a trigger causing a physical effect, as opposed to every time we're actually worried about bullets going through the environment, dropping due to gravity, hitting the guy here, causing some kind of special damage because of the arc and the aim and the angle and all that kind of stuff.
That'd be quite intensive, too.
It is much more intensive, and it's a lot harder to do, and that's why we just don't see it in a lot of games right now. I mean, over time, though, we're getting more games with bullet drop, but at the same time, bullet drop makes it harder to play. So we'll talk about that in a second, where physics starts to be a detriment to your game as opposed to a benefit. So does your collision system allow for trigger zones and soft bodies or simply solid or rigid body physics, as we call it? Rigid bodies is something like a table, a desk, a physical object that, you know, nobody's ever going to be able to go through. It's not going to ever turn into jelly or anything like that. It's always there. It might get shoved around, but it's always the same shape, same static kind of thing. That's what we usually refer to as rigid body physics. It can't bend. Whereas something like fluid dynamics, pouring water on somebody, or a large gelatinous ball that you can push or bubbles, right? Those are soft bodies. They morph and they shape and they flex. And that cloth is the large one that's called soft bodies, most people think of cloth physics, because we see that in quite a bit of games. Hair physics would also be sort of like soft body physics, and so on. Those are the two different things. And does our collision system allow for that, or can we only deal with rigid bodies? Or trigger zones. When cars drive on grass, we change the physics. It's sort of a trigger zone because they're in a grassy area versus on the pavement or on ice. We want to trigger a change in physics in those areas. So all of those kinds of things, different touching surfaces, touches, collisions, how an object can flex or form, those are all different pieces and categories of a physics system that you may have to evaluate on each individual basis for each object and figure out which ones you want to incorporate into your system. Obviously, the more you do, the more complex your physics system gets, the harder it is to do, the harder it is to debug, the harder it is to actually make the game react the way you want. So sometimes going overboard and putting all that physics in is actually a huge detriment to your system. So planning your approach is also important. How are we going to implement each object's physics? In some instances, we don't have one overarching physics system. It's not needed. We could get the job done for just worrying about the player's physics separately from the ring or the enemy and so on, and that's totally fine. Power-ups just floating around in the environment that can't be touched by anything other than the player. Really don't need physics then, because they're just there and they're just going to trigger when the player gets close to them. He looked like he touched them, but really you're just seeing if he was close enough, give it to him. It doesn't need to be a physical contact, okay? So certain things we can do in different ways. Do we want one system to rule them all? Or can we have individual actions combining everything into steering forces for those objects? For example, with bullets, you have gravity. You could include the Coriolis effect, which is the spinning of the Earth causing the bullet to drift. Some games have that in extreme sniper shots and so on. But those are all forces acting on that bullet. The initial projection, okay, the spin of the bullet, counteracting any wind, trying to change its direction, plus gravity pulling it down, plus the Coriolis effect of the Earth spinning, which really isn't a force on the object, but everything else is turning past your bullet, making it look like really your bullet is curving in a certain direction, right? All of those forces could be summed together into its final trajectory as it goes, and that would be this sort of individual actions combining into a single steering force. That's another way to approach a lot of physics-like situations. So bringing in an outside physics package is one way to hit this nail on the head. You know, you just pull in another package and bang, you bang it into your engine and everything's good. There's a lot of freeware ones out there that you can use. I don't know if I can mention them, but they are out there. and then there's also a lot of the AAA ones that you have to pay for that can do crazy amounts of things from fluid dynamics and fire and everything else realistically and crazy like that. So again, should I even use those? Well, for this demo, we chose to write our own physics system, and we're going to see why. Once we had evaluated really what we needed in order to get the job done, there's no point in bringing in one of these external physics packages.
Yeah, the setup and everything that would take the time, doesn't benefit us.
Exactly.
Right?
It's going to take more time to integrate the physics package into your engine than it is to do the actual coding of getting two cubes and a cylinder to collide, and there's just no real point to that. So that's why we've decided in this case... slap my microphone there, I apologize, people, we decided to code our own just to simplify things rather than do that. Now, the common pitfalls, one, people tend to sometimes not understand physics, and we might overload something. For example, your physics system may just be too realistic, we talked about that, it makes it too hard for people to play. All of those bullet drops, plus the Coriolis effect, plus wind, you know, works in certain games because those are really like simulators for bullet physics, and that's what we're doing. But in other spray and pray genres of, you know, some of the popular games that just came out recently, you don't want bullet drop, you don't want wind, you don't want any of that affecting a person's bullet because they already can't aim and they need to spray as much as possible. So there's too much realism sometimes for the player to understand to be able to use it as a mechanic. So we're going to simplify and abstract things out a lot to make it simpler, easier to understand, you know exactly where that bullet's going, and you can get the job done. Sometimes physics systems, too much overhead. Literally, it's just going to take you too long to calculate all of those bullets flying through with all that gravity and so on, and you just don't want to have to handle that. Too unpredictable for the player, like I mentioned. Overly complicated implementations. do you want to have to go through all of those physics and all that just for a nice, you know, bullet simulator? Maybe not. We sometimes use more dimensions than required. I can remember you made a certain toboggan game, correct?
Yes.
And what happened with that one? What was your physics approach for that?
Basically, we just said, you know, you're going downhill. We pretended as if you were on a flat plane, basically, right? Because we found out pretty quick that if we actually tried to do all the physics in that, it was too realistic. We were having a lot of problems where you get launched up into the air constantly and things like that. So we basically, yeah, we decided that we should probably just think of it as being on a flat plane and just moving you forward, but then we tilted the camera to give it the appearance that you were going downhill.
So it's an appearance of, I'm going down a hill, I'm having fun riding my little toboggan, but in actuality, the game has flattened it out. We are only doing two-dimensional physics. You can move left and right, forward and backwards, and that's it. We remove Z completely, or Y in this case, completely. We don't need it anymore. It now becomes a 2D game on a flat surface instead of a 3D game where you have to calculate all of those going down a hill at a 45-degree slope or 30-degree slope and so on, and it was just too much.
Yeah, it was too much, and it just, you know, it was giving us undesirable results, really.
Exactly. So that's some. That's the example I'm saying here, using too many dimensions that really you only need 2D, not 3D, to do that kind of thing. So those are the common pitfalls that people run into while setting up physics systems. So simplifying it down, keep it simple, okay? The KISS system definitely comes into play here. Common physics practices revolve around keeping things as simple as possible unless your game is truly about realistic physics, like most simulator genre games, flight simulators and that kind of stuff. Otherwise, it can be try to abstract it as much as possible because the user is not going to be able to understand what's going on to use it to his advantage anyways. It can degrade your gameplay. So abiding by that KISS mentality will generally lead to much less headaches, more productive work periods, better game in the end because the user knows what's going on. He can pick up the nuances in the system much faster. For example, many brick-breaking games have unrealistic physics on their paddles. All right, so the angle coming in of the ball to the paddle and ricocheting off, it should be angle in equals angle out, and the ball should go off. But if you look at a lot of those brick breaker games, if I hit the edge, it comes off almost like at a much steeper angle than it should. And they put that in there specifically because if you're in a box and you start doing perfect angle in, angle out, you would end up getting stuck in the exact same pattern every time, and you can't get out.
We actually had that happen to us when we did one. Same thing that was happening. We did the proper calculation thinking, oh, you know, this is a good idea. And then we quickly realized that you're getting stuck in that loop constantly. So
remember that? Yeah. What was the name of that one?
Rectangle Destroyer.
Rectangle Destroyer.
Had to dodge some copyrights.
So that's exactly that kind of situation that you're going to look for and be aware of. It can enhance your gameplay by actually having unrealistic physics. Bunny hopping, as my pictures are showing, rocket jumping, okay? Those are classics to some certain games I won't name that make them what they are. There's even classes of characters built around the fact that you can rocket jump, right? And so on and so on. Those are unrealistic physics things that went in, but then people started to exploit as a mechanic, and now they became so popular in the sequel to the game, they enhanced it and actually gave graphical effects to it, and so on, and built it out specifically for you to be able to do that. So those are those situations that, you know, can happen, but they're still fun, people still loved it. Even though it's an abstraction, it's not perfectly realistic. I don't expect to run around and rocket jump.
It's not a bug, it's a feature.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a bug, it's a feature. And that does happen quite a bit. So those are those kinds of things that can happen when you keep it simple. But at the same time, it's not detracting from your game. So it's not. Don't feel awkward about reducing your physics down to really just what you need. You don't need to do fully realistic physics every time. In fact, you probably shouldn't the majority of the time. All right, so that brings us to implementing the physics. It takes place during our update stage of the game loop. We saw that I pointed out the update dynamics function when we saw it briefly the one time. That's exactly where it happens. It typically happens right after the user input is determined. Okay, so it'll be in that stage of your update loop. Implementations also should be frame rate independent, meaning that we want to do our physics in a static stepping manner. Okay, we don't want to do it based on however many frames per second you're pumping. If we do that, when the graphics card lags or something else lags, the physics is going to miss collisions sometimes. You're going to end up going through walls, and you've probably seen that in games where there's those kinds of glitches during very hard, framey moments when there's enough smoke grenades or something in the flame, and you end up going through or not getting shot or not hitting the guy you thought you did. And that's because the physics system may be starting to miss those collisions because there's too much time between updates. So this will help to prevent bugs in that system due to frame rate spikes, and we don't simply use the delta time, the change in time between each update. Instead, we're going to have a nice stepwise implementation where we take however long this frame took. Maybe it's a second. That'd be a really laggy game, but still, we would then break that second down into smaller physics chunks where we do each step at 2 to 10 milliseconds each and do all of our physics updates, hoping to catch all of the collisions. Now, there are other ways to do this, like continuous collision systems that don't fall to that same kind of situation because they check the whole distance it moved as a ray from all the points and so on. It can pick up different things in different ways, but that's what we're going to do in this, create a fixed loop so we can hopefully catch every single step regardless of your frame rate. So the basics for that are here. We create a fixed update loop for our physics system. In this case, the update dynamics function, if you want to take a look at it. I've effectively, you know, crushed it down just to show what we're talking about here again. And we need some kind of timer to know when we started and so on and how much time has elapsed. Once we have that time, we're just going to say, while that the time left is greater than zero, take a chunk of time, do something with it. Do we have any more time? Do the physics again. Do we have any more time? Do the physics again. Excuse me. So here you can just see that's where effectively your code for all of your physics stuff is going to go down in here, operating based on however much time has gone by, which is our new delta time here, which is just a simple chunk effectively of our overall time that's left. And that's the kind of implementation you're going to look for these fixed update systems. So within that fixed time step, the loop will need to do something like the following. Start, obviously, the loop from the last slides, and then we update the player's position for physics. Might as well move him first. He's the most important, right? So we'll move him first based on any forces such as gravity or the player's input and so on. Then we're going to update all the AI and the NPCs and all those moving objects so that they're in their new position. And we need to include, again, any forces affecting them, such as gravity and so on, plus their own impulses because they're walking or rolling or running or whatever. And then we need to now check for every other object, see if it collides with the player. Okay, so that's going to be a lot of work, depending on your physics system and the number of things and objects you have in your game. So there is going to be a lot of processing happening here. And if a collision does occur, we've detected it in some manner, then we should push the objects apart based on whatever your laws of physics are. Maybe people are made of rubber and they bounce even farther apart than they were. Maybe you just don't allow them to go inside each other, so however much they're overlapping, you move them both back by a certain amount. Maybe the player can push everything around in your world. Okay, he can physically move everything else, but nothing moves him. So when he walks into something, it moves, but he continues to do whatever he wants, and that's fine. It just depends on your laws of physics and what you want to apply. But now you know a collision has happened between this object and the player. Do something about it. After that, we go to our loop where we check all of the other objects against all of the other objects, not the player. And that's even more work. But that way, if the player is pushing something, it might push something else and push something else and so on, and they'll spread out and move out of the way as he walks through a garbage heap or something like that. And again, maybe one of those objects can't move, and that should back everything back up because now they can't, and so on. And that's the overall process that you're going to be doing in your physics loop. After that, we can end it. Once we've done enough iterations due to the amount of time we needed, we leave and we continue on. So how do we implement collision detection, and what forces will we apply based on our game's needs? Well, we're going to do discrete collision detection. Okay, so in this method, we're going to check for collisions between the objects each step, and at a lower frame rate if we have a small, fast-moving object, it may end up teleporting past if we had two spheres, it may end up moving farther in one single step than the width of whatever object it was supposed to run into. So it'll go right past it. We won't detect any kind of collision in that case. So that's what our smaller steps of physics we're trying to do. But at the same time, we have to keep in mind that if we're going to have fast-moving objects, this probably isn't the best way to do that kind of physics. So bullets and things like that are going to need to do raycast or some other approach that's a more of a continuous or a swept check, which is what they're called, to figure out if it hit anything else along the entire path. And that's what these little images are really describing. It's just during a single step, as long as the box can never move faster than half its width, we know it'll always collide with everything. So we can sort of enforce rules if we want to make sure that sumo wrestlers can never move faster than half their bulk in 0.2 milliseconds.
I think we might be okay, though.
Okay, we're good. So as long as we can do that, we can ensure that this physics system will work all the time. So we won't ever have the problem where the sumo wrestler totally jumps right through the other sumo wrestler in less than 0.2 milliseconds or so. If you can guarantee me that, then you can do this kind of approach without any concerns, and you won't have any other problems. And that's really just what we're going to look at now. So detecting a cube-on-cube collision. That's what we have, right? That must be what we need. We have two cubes. They're going to collide with each other. How do we do that? Well, if they both happen to be axis-aligned cubes, meaning that all their three faces, their bottom, their right side, and their back side, line up with your X and Y and Z axis, it's very simple to do. You can do this check right here, which is a really long line of code, and I did have to crush it down to sort of fit it on the width of it. But basically, it just checks the one side's maximum X value versus the minimum X value of the other object, and then the first object's minimum X value versus the maximum, and so on of the other object for Y and for Z in all those directions. We know that the one object must be somehow inside the other or not. So it's actually very easy, as long as they're always aligned to the axes. That's not going to happen in ours.
No, unfortunately not.
No. The sumo wrestlers are going to push each other, they're going to rotate to face each other and keep pushing each other. They're going to be rotating around Y in all different directions. So we can't use this approach. So we have to go a little bit more complex if we're going to do a cube-on-cube collision. Now, other than that little cheat code input stuff, they can't fly. Mm-hmm. So are they ever going to land on each other?
Preferably not.
No, exactly. They're not actually going to land on each other. So instead, we don't need to do a cube on cube. Really, they can have no height whatsoever. It doesn't matter. They're effectively just squares on a mat. Now we only have to do square on square collision. It makes things possibly a little bit simpler. So that's that part I was talking about earlier. Find out what you need to apply physics to stuff, but then simplify it as much as possible. We don't need to be doing cube checks when really the shadow of them on the ground is enough, because they never leave the ground. They can't go over top of each other, so why do we have to check the fact that he has height? Just check where their limits are as a square on the mat. That would be good enough, banging into each other. So they're never going to leave the ground. We're not going to consider them as cubes anymore. A simple square projected onto the mat is going to work much better. So that brings us to, how do we implement a non-axis aligned square on square collision? At that point, we think to ourselves, are we going to do a whole bunch of work that doesn't need to be done? Is there an even simpler way we could do this before we worry about doing all this? Because again, the calculation is actually pretty large to do this. Is there any other simpler ways?
I think we can come up with one.
Okay, you're right. We can. Because we have made the sumo wrestlers rotate to face each other, okay, we actually don't even need to use squares. Because they're going to be rotating to face each other, really, the distance from the center of them to their outwards edge at any point in time is the maximum distance they're ever going to be apart from each other. So effectively, that's just a radius check in a circle, because they're always going to rotate to face each other to push each other away. So we never even really need to worry about the fact that they're squares. In essence, they're a circle, or even more abstract than that, they're a point in space that has a line that you must stay a certain distance away, and that is it. So we can do a simple sphere or distance check, that would suffice. So basically, to do that, we simply take the radius of the one inner circle, add it to the radius of the other guy's circle, in essence, which is that distance from the center point to their edge, Then we subtract the center point of one circle from the other. That gives us the vector between the two, which we can get the magnitude of and the resultant vector of that, compare that to the sum of the radius, and if one is less than the other, we know that they are within the circular radius of each other or not, based on their center points and that distance. So we just compare the two radii added together to the distance between the center points.
And like you said, it goes right back to, you know what your game needs, right?
Yes.
And we were, you know, quickly we figured out that we didn't need to go through all that extraneous calculations just to figure out, you know, where two sumo wrestlers are and if they've collided.
Exactly. So in the end, our planning our 8-bit sumo wrestlers worked out in our favor. It simplifies everything we needed to do. Okay, now if you want more in-depth physics or you want to see how to do some of those more complicated stuff, we're going to point you to another demo, the first-person shooter demo that Microsoft has also made that has a lot more, is this touching that, of different shapes such as a quad, a face, a cylinder, and a cube, and some other shapes like that for that demo purposes. So you can see how that works. But really, the physics step system will be exactly the same. They'll just be calculating whether or not these two objects are touching inside that pseudocode at the same spot and then dealing with it at that point. So how we set up the physics system is still exactly the same as it is here, but the actual checks that we need to do on whether or not two things are colliding become a little more complex. And so we've abstracted that out of this demo so we don't have to deal with that. We're just going to look at a simplified version of it. So let's jump into the code here now, and we will take a look at that exact setup. Alrighty, so going in here again, that's not the right class. There we go. In our sumo DX class, and I'll just zoom in a second as soon as I run down to where I want to be. There we go. All right, so update dynamics. All right, that is the function inside our run game, which gets called by the default DirectX app class that we built. Every frame update, it's going to call run game to let us do a little bit. We update the timer. We position the camera to be looking wherever the controller says we should be. We update the player's velocity based on what the input is from the controller. So again, we've done all that input stuff first. Now we go into physics. And that's this function here. So if I jump down to that, we need to know how much time has elapsed. So we get our delta time from our timer. All right, and when that's our time frame. And that's how much time is left that we want to calculate for physics. So we're starting with all of that time, and we're going to chew away at that each fixed physics update until we have no time left, and then we're going to move on. So while that time left is greater than zero, we're going to go ahead, grab a smidgen of time out of here, and subtract that from the time left, and now use that, whatever that frame length is that I set in the constants file, or class. So we have that set, I think it's 0.2 or something like that, milliseconds. 2 milliseconds, I think, is what it is, sorry. And we then update the player's position. That's the first step we said. So we tell the player to change his position to be wherever he is, wherever he is currently, added to whatever the velocity is that we just got from our input controller, multiplied by however much time this physics step is done. Okay, so he may be moving at 5 kilometers an hour, but, or sorry, I should convert that, or 5 miles an hour, either way, it doesn't matter. And then delta time, we're only moving 2 milliseconds, so we only move a very small step. All right, but that gets added to his original position, and he has now moved. So we have now moved the player, we've changed his position. Now we're gonna do something like determine what the AI is gonna do and where he's gonna move. We'll look at that in the next module. So once it's decided where it's going and what it's trying to do to push the player out, we go down and we check for any player-enemy collision. Now, the setup to do that, like I said, the first thing we have to do is find the distance in X and Z between their two center points. So we just quickly do a difference in Z and a difference in X by subtracting the two from each other. We now know how far away they are in both those directions. And now we want to calculate an overlap of basically the magnitude of that vector. Now, because I've been grabbing it as floats, I just take one float, multiply it by the other. So that's squaring x, and then I add it to the square of z, and now I square root that whole thing. And because the sumos are 1 unit wide, the radius is 0.5 of each sumo to the edge of their face. So I've subtracted 1 because that's the adding the two radii together. Rather than write it in, this is effectively an optimization, why make the computer do it? You probably want to make this a constant, though, in case you change the sizes or something like that. I've done a bad thing, and I've hard-coded that value in, and I will slap myself for it. Oh, there you go. And in the future, I wouldn't do that, but this now is doing our radius versus our distance point difference, and this gives us back the amount those two sumos are overlapping. All we have to do now is separate them by that amount. To do that, though, we have to know in which direction they are facing each other. So again, we can just take the vector position of the enemy and subtract our position. That gives us a direction from the player to the enemy that we can now move each of them away in positive and negative direction along that vector by half this overlap. And that's what we do right here. So if overlap is less than zero, because a negative number means there has been a contact, I simply move the player and the enemy backwards or forwards based on our player to enemy direction, depending on who they are, by half the overlap value. Now they both separate by the same amount. So whenever they collide, in whichever order, it doesn't matter who hit who, but they both get shoved back slightly. I mean, you can think of sumos, they're a little squishy, okay? They ram into each other and they bounce back just a slight little bit every time. That's effectively what we've set up there. So that is really all we needed for our physics, and that's it. And that's the end of that function, in fact. The dynamics is done. What are we missing? What physics didn't we do? They banged into each other, but what about the platform?
Oh, yeah, we haven't checked to see if we've actually left the platform.
We haven't checked if we left the platform. In fact, there's no gravity. We're not even standing on the platform and so on. No, we don't need any of that part physics-wise. Mm-hmm. Because our platform is effectively a cylinder, it's a circle, it's another radius check. If the guy has gotten a certain distance away, you've left the surface. Why check if you're on the cylinder? I don't need that physics, that physicality. It's abstract. It's not required in this result. So why calculate any of that?
Yeah, right. Makes sense.
So instead, if I go back into the code here, we'll see that in our sumo dx, sorry, I got to scroll up here. Oh, actually, I can jump right back. Whee! Right down here in our update function. Oh, it didn't jump back to where I thought it would. There it goes. Right there. Did either one of them leave the mat? So it's not really a physics check. We're just checking how far away they are from the origin. So is their position, is the magnitude greater than 10? If it is, I know they've left my 10-meter mat. And that's it. So that's all we've done. Same with the enemy. I check if he's gone beyond 10 meters from the center of the origin of the world, which happens to be the center of the mat, because I've arranged all those things being tricky and knowing I don't want to have to do any physics for that. Mm. And that's it.
Yeah, a lot less work than having to apply gravity and seeing if they'd fallen a certain percentage or whatever it might be. Yeah. Yep.
But I mean, we might want to add that as a neat little effect. When they have triggered that they've gone too far, start moving them down as if they're actually falling off a giant tower or something like that.
But again, we don't really need to use gravity for that.
No, you just, when this trips, you say, oh, you now have a downwards velocity. We lock out the player input and the guy just falls. And that's it. There's no real physics needed behind that.
So far today, we've bent times and space. We've created our own physics laws. I think we're doing pretty good here.
That's right. We're on the way. So that's pretty much all there is to it. I guess that's the end for this module. We're going to wrap it up with the next module.
Yeah, so we'll take a quick 10-minute break. Yep. We'll come back, and we'll talk about AI. And
I guess if you have any questions, maybe start thinking about them and forming them. And if we have some time at the end of the next module, we can do a little Q&A.
Sounds good.
Okay.
All right, see you in 10.